The Tom Woods Show, episode 2129.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy The Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I thought I would spend a little time today talking about something that a lot of people are concerned about, and that is the proposed pandemic treaty from the World Health Organization, WHO. And it's still not entirely clear exactly what form this treaty would take, so it might be best to call it some kind of an instrument. Some people have said it would be amendments to the World Health Organization's constitution, but it could well be a standalone treaty. That's possible. Then complicating matters further is that next week, now I'm recording this on May 20th, 2022, next week they're also going to be talking about amendments to international health regulation going back to 2005. So that's going on simultaneously with this pandemic treaty. So it's very possible to get confused about everything that's happening. There's so much going on. So I'll do my best here. Now, of course, because we don't have a treaty to look at, we can only speculate as to what they might have in mind. But by looking at a couple of the proposed amendments to the international health regulation from 2005, we can get a sense of the direction in which they're moving. We can extrapolate, I think, justly from that to get a sense of where they're moving. And the Biden people seem to be pushing changes to this international health regulation from 2005 in a direction that would lead the World Health Organization down a more dictatorial path. That is to say, there would be less consultation with a country where it has been declared that there is some health emergency and more barking out orders at that country and trying to isolate that country. So, for example, one of the proposed amendments would delete a sentence that said, WHO shall consult with and attempt to obtain verification from the state party in whose territory the event, the health event, is allegedly occurring. They want to eliminate that sentence. Elsewhere, they want to remove these words, taking into account the views of the state party concerned. They want that removed. Early this year, we were told by the director general of the WHO that, and these are his words, we all want a world in which science triumphs over misinformation. That's rich for him to say that. Half the misinformation is coming from him. Solidarity triumphs over division, and equity is a reality, not an aspiration. We are one world. We have one health. We are one WHO. Well, that is just insane narcissism, but that's what he had to say. He also said that it should be a priority, his word, to, quote, urgently strengthen WHO as the leading and directing authority on global health at the center of the global health architecture. Well, I don't want that. I don't want this thing strengthened in any way. Obviously, it's a dystopian nightmare. And I'm not even going to try to prove that because I assume by now people who listen to this podcast already know that. If you need some evidence on this, I've got many, many fine episodes of The Tom Woods Show you can look at tomspodcast.com that will talk about the various claims made and how true they've turned out to be. What I think we all fear is that the finished product would basically result in something like, given that the WHO, although it did make timid protests here and there, that lockdowns should be only a last resort and they're being overused. Yeah, okay, but they talked out of both sides of their mouth through that whole thing. I think the concern is that you would have this runaway organization that, you know, is like a Bill Gates monster, because of course he's a big part of influencing it, that you'd have this institution ordering countries to impose mask mandates, to lock down, to demand vaccines be taken, to establish international standards for vaccine passports. You can see all these things materializing under an agreement like that. And that's what people fear could happen. Bill Gates himself has apparently announced that he is helping to create the Global Epidemic Response and Mobilization Team for the WHO. I mean, you can imagine what that'll be used for. So they're going to decide when your society needs to shut down and when you need to close your borders and when you need to wear a useless mask. Now, getting back for a minute to these amendments being proposed to the International Health Regulation of 2005, these proposed amendments, as I say, I think give us a sense of where things are moving, and they're moving in a more centralized direction. Obviously, there's nothing in the international elites that says, let individual countries and localities make decisions for themselves. Their brains don't work that way. So we read among these amendments, for example, that when the WHO informs a country that they are at a, quote, potential risk of a public health emergency, that country has 48 hours to hand over its public health information, including genetic sequence data. All right, so who gets to decide when there's a public health emergency afoot? Well, of course, it's the Director General of the WHO. And even when, quote, an event has not been determined to meet the criteria for a public health emergency, unquote, the Director General can still issue a public health alert. So we don't know what criteria are being used. The Director General can override the judgment of the people in the targeted country. So again, you can see the trend here. The trend is for centralization and for people who behaved atrociously during the COVID fiasco to get more power and be even less accountable. Of course, I could not possibly be more against this after covering this for 2 years and watching the story change over and over and the normal people, the people on Team Reality, we call them, being vindicated again and again and again. Of course, I'm against this. At the same time, what is the enforcement mechanism? What are they going to do if a country just doesn't listen? What, are they going to put the whole country in jail? There is no enforcement mechanism. There's nothing they can do. So we do need to bear that in mind. For example, that's the opinion of Robert Barnes, and he's not a squish. He's no marshmallow, that guy. He says that this is basically an unloaded gun, that the real threat is our own Department of Health and Human Services. The real threat is the National Institutes of Health, the CDC, our own people right here at home. As usual, our worst enemy is right here at home. We do not need to go abroad looking for it. It's right here. If those people want to do something, they're going to do it, whether or not there's this international treaty or this international set of regulations. They're going to do it whether or not that exists. And that's where our efforts primarily need to be concentrated. Take, for example, the Geneva Conventions, which deal with POWs, but primarily with the conduct of war as regards to how it affects civilians, people who are not participants in it. Well, we hear all in the news all the time, so-and-so violated the Geneva Convention. Okay, then what happens? Does that country go to jail? Nothing happens. The most plausible scenario in which this kind of document could hurt us would be the following, that you have a president like Biden who's in sympathy with the WHO, and he says to the country, we have to do the following things because the WHO has made a determination. And since we are signatories to this, we are obligated to do it. Like, it is our legal requirement to do it. It is binding upon us. And so, therefore, I am going to demand that the various state governors comply, because not to comply would be to violate an agreement that we are party to, that we are signatory to. So that would be the issue. Would a president do that? Now, again, what's he going to do to governors who say, well, I don't care about some stupid international organization. I care about the U.S. Constitution. So go jump in a lake. I would certainly encourage a governor to do that. But what if the Supreme Court comes back and says, well, it turns out that actually you do have to abide by this? Then it gets tricky. Again, you could still resist that, but it just makes life more difficult, would be my point. It's not that we would necessarily be doomed if this went into effect, but it would be harder to mount a resistance to it. Now, this issue about international treaties and the U.S. Constitution and the extent to which a treaty could override the Constitution, or a treaty could, in effect, require the U.S. to do certain things domestically so that the U.S. government could impose some unconstitutional program on us and say, well, you know, we are signatories to this, you know, let's say the UN Charter or something, and it demands that we do such and such. That's the kind of thing that people have actually been worried about for a long time. So I actually want to devote the balance of this episode to a little history lesson that is pretty important these days. And that has to do with a failed, but only barely failed, constitutional amendment called the Bricker Amendment that would clarify that the Constitution is higher than any treaty, that the U.S. government could not sign, let's say, the UN Declaration on Human Rights and then turn around and say, well, now we have to impose all this new legislation on you because, well, that's what this treaty demands of us and the Constitution be damned. So that was a concern that people started to have, that that could happen. In particular, it began around the time of World War II and thereafter with the establishment of the United Nations. As a matter of fact, if you can imagine a world in which the American Bar Association was extremely concerned about threats to American sovereignty, that sounds like something from another planet. The American Bar Association is going to, they would laugh at that now. But they were concerned about it back in the 1940s and 1950s. And their president at the time, Frank Holman, was really the guy whose brainchild the Bricker Amendment was. And so in 1952, the American Bar Association, if you can believe this, endorsed the idea of a constitutional amendment that would safeguard the Constitution from erosion by international treaty. The key case that we have to know something about in this conversation goes back to 1920. It's the case of Missouri versus Holland. And it had to do with a seemingly benign topic. It had to do with state regulation of the treatment of certain species of migratory birds. The dispute in the case went back to 1913. In 1913, Congress passed a measure that established federal regulations over the killing, capturing, or selling of these kinds of birds. And at the time, federal courts said the states have the power to deal with these issues under the 10th Amendment, and Congress is usurping the rights of the states. Well, in 1916, Woodrow Wilson codified those regulations in a treaty with Great Britain. So now they were part of a treaty. And then the Supreme Court upheld them and cited the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. The court said that if, quote, the treaty is valid, then there can be no dispute about the validity of the statute as a necessary and proper means to execute the power of the government. So understand what happened here. You had some regulations, federal regulations, regarding treatment of migratory birds. Initially, federal courts said, well, this is not a federal government power, so under the 10th Amendment, the states have this power. But then Woodrow Wilson entered into a treaty that included these powers, and then the Supreme Court said, well, if a treaty says it, then any statute upholding the provisions of the treaty has to be okay. Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. Now that case, Missouri versus Holland, would be cited several more times in several subsequent cases, expanding the power of the central government. But it took on really profound significance, and it was subsequently elaborated on in a case, 1942, United States versus Pink, but at the time of the creation of the United Nations. The United Nations Charter had been ratified with the explicit assurance that it authorized no UN interference in the domestic concerns of the United States or any other member nation. the U.S. would never have lent its support to it, wouldn't have gotten the public support for it, if that stipulation had not been included. But now you have these court decisions suggesting that some kind of international agreement can indeed trump the Constitution. What that means is that whatever popular control exists over the government would be severely attenuated, because we can say, well, sorry you have that opinion, but we just have to execute this agreement that we made with such and such country or with the United Nations or whatever. And there were plenty of American social reformers who said that the U.S. government needs to do A, B, C, and D because the U.N. Charter demands it. The key figure in pushing back against this was Senator John Bricker of Ohio. That's why it became known as the Bricker Amendment. He had been following the discussions in the American Bar Association Journal having to do with the ambiguity of the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. The Supremacy Clause, remember, reads as follows: "The Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding." So the Bricker Amendment included several crucial provisions. So first, any provision of a treaty that conflicted with the letter of the Constitution would be null and void automatically. Secondly, a treaty would become effective as internal law within the United States only with the passage of appropriate legislation by Congress. So that meant that treaties would not be self-executing. And then finally, the amendment would rein in the executive with the requirement that all executive agreements between the president and any international organization or foreign power, quote, be made only in the manner and to the extent to be prescribed by law, unquote. And then such agreements, quote, shall be subject to the limitations imposed on treaties or the making of treaties, unquote. So the purpose of this stipulation was to make sure the executive couldn't evade the requirements for treaties just by calling them executive agreements instead. Teddy Roosevelt had done that, by the way. He knew he couldn't get a treaty ratified, so he just called it an executive agreement. It had to do with the Dominican Republic. Now, the Bricker Amendment was supported by what we might call the old right. It was supported by that cantankerous group of anti-New Dealers who were not particularly organized, but who nevertheless were the opposition to the regime at the time. But on the other hand, the Eisenhower Republicans were dead set against it. They didn't want anything that would tie the president's hands, particularly in matters of foreign policy. So they were dead set against it. And so you could imagine it being proposed today. You know exactly who would support it and who would be against it. Now, at this time, the libertarian movement was non-juvenile and supported it. So The Freeman, which is published by the Foundation for Economic Education, one of the main libertarian organizations since World War II, in The Freeman, Frank Holman of the American Bar Association said the Bricker Amendment was necessary to preserve, quote, our basic rights as protected by our own Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Henry Hazlitt, author of Economics in One Lesson, supported it. So the good guys supported this thing. It was the weirdo globalist people who pretended to find some problem with it. One of my favorite, if not my very favorite, critic of the New Deal, Garrett Garrett. I mean, I know it maybe it's Garrett Garrett, but I don't want to pronounce it that way. I like the idea that his name is Garrett Garrett. But he was great on this too. And he saw that this was a populist measure against the Washington establishment. He said that what was really at stake was the people's ability to have a voice in the kind of international agreements that would be binding on and the protection of everyone's constitutional rights. But again, I can just imagine today, if we had the Bricker Amendment being proposed, I can just imagine all the people in the right wing, allegedly, in the conservative movement, and certainly in the libertarian movement, who crave respectability. They would have run as far from this thing as possible because this was very non-respectable. What ultimately happened was that a watered-down version of the amendment, known as the George Amendment, failed by one vote to get the two-thirds majority of the Senate. A lot of Republicans withdrew their support for it because they heard the Eisenhower administration was against it and they wanted to be loyal to the president. But the point is, this is a significant moment in American history, the Bricker Amendment controversy, because it foreshadowed what we're experiencing today, didn't it? They're concerned about the very things that concern us today. And the battle lines are drawn exactly the way they are today. Exactly. You have party establishments who would die 1,000 deaths before approving something like this. And then you have the rest of us. So because of that ambiguity, there is still the concern that the Supreme Court could say, well, such and such is binding on the American people, and there's no authority for a state to resist it. That would be the thing. It's primarily our own Supreme Court we have to be worried about. Because if we could be assured that the Supreme Court would say that no treaty can supersede the Constitution, and no treaty can give the federal government extra powers that were never delegated to it, and no treaty can usurp the rights of the people in the states, there'd be no problem. Now, as I say, right now, the information we have about all this is fairly limited. But what we know about the way these people have been acting and what we've seen with the proposed amendments to that international health regulation, it's not encouraging, let's say. It's not encouraging. So what I'll do is, at tomwoods.com/2129, I'll put a few links of some of the preliminary pieces that have been written on this. Obviously, these will be superseded in the coming weeks as we learn more. But for now, I'll share with you what information we do have on that show notes page. So tomwoods.com/2129. Now, I am not putting this episode on YouTube because it'll just be taken down. I'm sure I said all kinds of things that I'm not allowed to say. So if you like and appreciate what I'm doing, I hope you'll join my no censorship group. We are not on Facebook, of course. I have a no censorship group that is one of the many benefits I give to people who support this program. And I would very, very much like to see you in there. We have a really, really great group of smart, bright, congenial folks where you can stay up on what's really happening in the world, have good conversations, not be called names, and learn an awful lot. It's a tremendous, tremendous community. And if you like the Tom Woods Show and you're not in there, then your life is incomplete. So to get in there, head over to supportinglisteners.com. I'll see you next week, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.